Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I recently spent an evening, as I bet you have too, a lot of evenings, talking about the presidential campaign. Because what else? The evening I'm talking about was a little over a week ago, and I spent it with three of the best political thinkers I know. Amy Davidson is a columnist for The New Yorker, where she watches like a hawk pretty much every move the candidates make. Kelly Fasano has profiled a number of the Republicans who are or were in the race, and the guest of honor was Nate Silver, who runs the blog 538. Silver isn't a journalist exactly, but a statistics guru, and he's got the best track record for predicting elections of anyone. But this campaign is putting even his powers of prediction to the test. We met in front of a small audience at a place called the Neue House in Manhattan. I'd like to start with Nate Silver. I don't know how to ask this question any better, and I'd be remiss in failing to start this conversation with anything other than Donald Trump.
I had a feeling that would be that.
Yeah, good come guess. Good guess. Why? That's my question. In other words, we have been hearing for years about social dislocation, economic problems, demographic shifts in the country, radicalism within the Republican Party. And yet, at the end of the day, the Republican Party sooner or later came around to putting forward John McCain, Romney, and now we have somebody who's been a figure of bizarre fun and ego and, you know, sort of gold-plated craziness since the late 70s. And if I had told you a couple of years ago that Donald Trump would be leading the way, you'd laugh at me.
That's true. I mean, we would have laughed at ourselves, I suppose, too. But look, I think there are three essential elements to the Trump story, and that any kind of accurate tale of Trump has to tell from these three perspectives. One is from the perspective of the voter. You know, part of the Trump story is about nationalism and racism. From what we can tell, his voters do care a lot about immigration. They are not fans of Obama. They're very anti-Obama. They don't care as much about social issues such as abortion and gay marriage. They don't care as much about big government versus small government. So it's a different kind of more European bouquet of issues that they care about. The second part of the story is a party story about the Republican Party, both in the long term, maybe having sold a bill of goods to its voters. And I think it was Josh Marshall at TPM who talked about when you do a project quickly at work, and we discover this too, there's kind of a debt that you pay. You patch something together and it works fine, but then it might break down really badly later on. And the GOP has had a lot of close calls. 2012, the nomination process wasn't that close a call, but still at this point in the process, Rick Santorum was still and Newt Gingrich were still viable contenders. Obviously, the various government shutdowns and more critically debt ceiling negotiations have gone up to the brink. Getting a new Speaker of the House, you know, you would kind of think that if you are on the verge of a disaster 10 times and avoid one, that's not a sign that you miraculously avoid disaster. It's a sign that sooner or later, like if you're driving drunk, you're going to get into a crash. The other side of that story,
so this is like drunk driving or terrorism. It only has to happen once for it to succeed.
Well, look, I mean, I think inherently still, with all this said, a lot of things have had to go wrong for Trump to be in this position. And one thing that is important to keep in mind is that for all the discussion of Trump, he still only has won 34% of the vote. And there are polls suggesting that if you had a strong alternative to Trump, that he would tie or lose maybe, that he is actually relatively unpopular for a GOP frontrunner. And the third part, I don't want to hog too much time, but there's also a media story, too, where Trump has spent his whole career learning how to get attention, to manipulate the media. He, however, has close relationships with people in the media. People say, oh, behind the scenes, he's a good guy. He gives a lot of access. And if you give both access and ratings, then you'll get covered a lot. It's appropriate to cover Trump, certainly to a degree, but I think on the network news in all of 2015, Trump got 9 times more coverage than Marco Rubio, 9 times more than Ted Cruz, and that's a unique circumstance. It won't stop anytime soon, but you know, the media is kind of a third wheel in this drama.
So, Amy Davidson, Nate makes the point that he's overexposed, or he's getting way more time on the air than anybody else. Why is that, and what is the media doing wrong, if anything?
I don't believe that he's overcovered. If anything, I believe that he's been undercovered. I think that there was a candidate who was overcovered despite all information about what voters thought and what voters were interested in, and that was Jeb Bush. With Trump, he was covered as a phenomenon, but there was always the addendum that this isn't actually about a candidate. You know, you had the three perspectives, but let's add a fourth one that I think might be important, which is Donald Trump's.
As a personality, as a performer?
As a decision maker in this process. Because a lot of the coverage was premised on the idea that the minute he's bored, he's out of here. Or he's only in this to, you know, buff up his brand. But also, I think that there was a point when, early in the primary process, when Trump looked around at the other candidates, and more, I think, than the press did, recognized their weakness.
So, Califa, you've now heard 4 reasons of why we're where we are with Donald Trump. And maybe more than any writer at The New Yorker, you've spent a fair amount of time writing about, thinking about conservatism, libertarianism. Is that an adequate map that they've sketched out for the reasons why? Does it satisfy you?
Well, I think that there is a political ideological element too, which is that, you know, Trump is someone who doesn't care that much about politeness, and he's willing to violate all sorts of norms about what nasty names you shouldn't call people, etc. And he's also willing to violate some of our political norms. And the thing that he's noticed, either through strategy or through sheer accident, is that there are certain issues where voters feel as if they're not being spoken for, certain issues where voters feel like the elite consensus doesn't reflect how they feel. And similarly, on free trade, if you're
but
someone
how
who's...
is it that the person that's articulating it most successfully, and I open it up to all of you, is a guy who's a real estate magnate living in a golden tower with golden golf clubs and a golden jet plane, and who was born on not on third base, but practically sliding into home. My great-grandmother lived in, and we've constantly visited her in Coney Island, in a Trump building. This is not a self-made man. This is not a log cabin story that we constantly require of our presidents. How does he become the mouthpiece and the articulator, the most successful articulator, of American raw populism? Amy.
Well, the word of this election is rigged. People believe the system is rigged. Trump comes out and says, it sure is. I've been part of the rigging. They're all corrupt. All of them. All of the guys on the
stage. And he says
it
without damage to himself.
Well,
he basically says, I pay politicians to do my bidding.
It's like Augustine. It's like I've been part of the corruption, and now I'm here to tell you all about it. The other thing is that we're so distracted, we think the gold paint is disqualifying. Most of America, you know,
for all of this
year when Trump supposedly got all of this attention, the only real case that was being made against him was an aesthetic case, that a guy like this can't be president, a guy who's so tacky, a guy who's so rude, as if what Americans are desperate for is the most polite, tasteful president.
Figure in Downton Abbey.
You know that, and also to see politicians who people know at this point spend a huge amount of their time asking rich people for money, to have them be saying we're the serious, tasteful ones, and that guy who's exactly the kind of guy who supports us is so not of the right sort.
Kay, I didn't want to cut you off on your point, but you, in terms of support, your analysis of Trump's support.
Well, I mean, again, that's part of it is that there are these issues. If you're someone who's really concerned about the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, and you want someone who's full-throatedly speaking against that and speaking out about immigration, weirdly, you don't have a lot of options. And as we've seen with Cruz and Rubio going at each other, both of them, from the perspective of someone who's an immigration restrictionist, both of them are vulnerable. Neither of them is quote-unquote pure on this issue. So to mangle two expressions at once, it's with Trump, it kind of is the triumph of audacity over hope. It is this sense that he's willing to say this thing that has been literally thought to be unsayable in American politics, perhaps for good reason, but in any case, he's willing to say it.
Here's a weird dilemma that I'm in, is that for a long time we've been skeptical of Trump, and I think we still are. We still think the one thing that's missing is a recognition of how many Republican voters resist him. But the path for the other candidates is also really problematic.
Amy, let me cheat. Your politics are not a secret. And we were talking about Trump and Ted Cruz, and you said what a lot of people say who are political liberals. Cruz is worse. Let's talk about Ted Cruz, who seems to be the one candidate, maybe I'm wrong, but seems to be the one candidate, and Nate will correct me on the numbers here, who has the best shot of possibly squeezing into the left lane and passing Trump, although maybe no time soon. Why do you say that?
I look at Ted Cruz, I listen to Ted Cruz. He seems to me the candidate most likely to start a war out of sheer intellectual vanity. He's a real extremist. And it's fascinating that, you know, the GOP finally mustering to respond to Trump and to Trumpism, that the argument that Ted Cruz has been pushing and pushing hard is that Donald Trump is a raging liberal. And that the GOP needs to be more pure, more ideologically extreme. You know, they all want a wall.
But Trump's vulnerability, if I'm reading what Nate is telling us in 538 and here tonight, is that Trump's vulnerability is not his so-called liberal positions, but rather he's embarrassing to too many people. He's outrageous to too many people to bring them on board. Is that right, Nate?
I mean, I think he has a lot of strengths and a lot of vulnerabilities. One mistake Republicans made, and not until pretty recently, attacking him, there was a lot of coverage. It wasn't particularly focused, I guess you'd say. There was kind of a paralysis of any real strategy against Trump. And that part's interesting, too. I think maybe people thought he would go away, potentially. Other people thought he was inevitable. It was kind of this weird thing where...
And, you know, when we talk about why the other Republicans didn't attack him early on, yeah, there was the not serious, but there was also they wanted his voters. They wanted what he had. They just wanted the cover. And, you know, they wanted to excite the same passions. They wanted to get the same hatred on their side. And they didn't want to offend his voters by attacking him because they hoped that they would be the subtler object
who can win
of their affection.
And that's the thing. If you're a politician and you see that kind of passion and you see those kinds of crowds, it's a little hard to resist. It's really hard for a politician to say, no, we don't want those people. We don't want that candidate. We've got to keep our party sensible. And the idea that a politician on any side would be somehow would not be vulnerable to that temptation or that kind of excitement. Politicians live for that. They live for the idea of here's someone that can really attract a bunch of people.
Nate, unless I'm wrong, you wrote a piece about what happens to parties in crises like these.
Oh, one of my colleagues did. But I mean, look, one question is the GOP in the midst of a realignment? Because these things do happen every 40 or 60 years. And one of the problems with kind of a narrowly focused empiricism is that kind of all the data we use to understand how nomination processes work come from 1972 or 1980 or so onward, when the two-party system has been fairly stable. It's kind of right after you saw the last big flip where the New Deal coalition broke apart and Southern Democrats and Northern Democrats no longer agreed very much and they became Republicans. So what are the rules once you're undergoing one of these in real time? I don't know. You know, then there's still a part of me that thinks, even though the Trump thing is enormously consequential, what if it's all just some weird one-off fluke?
You mean what if it's Ross Perot?
Yeah, and it never replicated again. It's just like we kind of forget about it for you. I mean, I don't think there are still good lessons from it no matter what.
Trust me, I'll never forget it.
But I mean, what if early on...
You think it's just an air bubble in the pipe?
I don't think so, but I think you have to have multiple. I think it probably is a crisis for the GOP. I'm like 75% sure of that, but 25% of me thinks that...
Or perhaps it's what's called Obama derangement syndrome, that the phenomenon of Barack Obama as a figure, racially and to some extent ideologically, and also the fact that the Obama side has in many ways won the culture wars, whether it's gay marriage or any number of things, that there is a reaction to it.
But think about what realignment would really require. Think about a populist GOP. Does that mean that they support the higher minimum wage and then this newly kind of elite-dominated Democratic Party is opposed to a higher minimum wage? I mean, it's a little hard to imagine.
Nate, let's move to the Democrats. The standard narrative here is that Hillary Clinton has all kinds of problems, all sorts of vulnerabilities, some of them having to do with weariness or wariness or reputation for slipperiness, but a reputation among enough voters for competence and intelligence, some voters eager to see a woman at last in the White House as president. But Bernie Sanders has brought something to this election. He's clearly... maybe not so clearly, but it looks like he's not going to make it past an image as a kind of insurgency and somebody who's influencing the front runner. How do you see the narrative any different than that?
I think Hillary Clinton is an underrated politician in many respects, including doing some of the basic blocking and tackling stuff, I'd call it. But, you know, she's a good, if not perfect, debater. She cares about policy. I think sometimes she gets too lost in the weeds and is vulnerable to kind of soaring rhetoric on both sides. But there's no doubt that Democrats are moving to the left. There's just less, as a horse race, it's easier to analyze. Because as a horse race, this is a game that we've played before. It's a basketball game, you can kind of say. Well, Team Clinton's ahead by 15 points. I know it's only, you know, early in the third quarter, but you can do the math. With a GOP race, we don't even know the rules of engagement anymore. So it's different.
Okay.
I mean, when I was watching some of those early states and the success that Sanders was having, I couldn't help but think that Hillary Clinton was lucky in a sense. In other words, the person that she drew as her major opponent was not super youthful, was very polite when you compare it to the Republican side, very kind of polite and restrained in his attacks on her, unwilling to talk about one thing that might be one of her biggest vulnerabilities in a Democratic primary, which is foreign policy. I mean, this is someone who was Secretary of State, supported things that a lot of Democrats might not support, and yet she draws as her opponent someone who does not want to talk about foreign policy. And sometimes it seemed to me like Bernie Sanders was something of a placeholder and a vessel into which people could pour whatever frustration they felt about Hillary Clinton, but someone who didn't necessarily generate the kind of passion that, I don't know, maybe Elizabeth Warren might have generated if she were in the race.
Amy, I sense in you somebody who was not somebody who saw perfection personified in Hillary Clinton. Now, you're very tough on her in many columns. And yet, if I'm reading you right, and I, God knows I read you, that you've changed a bit. You've not softened where she's concerned, but you've grown more comfortable with her, sympathetic with her to a degree. Is that fair?
My worry about Hillary Clinton is that the sort of institutional decision that she would be the candidate. And that's happened twice now. It happened in 2008, didn't quite work out. It happened now. Has kind of pushed down the emergence of a new generation of Democratic politicians. Every Democratic woman in the Senate, and there are 16 Democratic women in the Senate, I think every one of them, maybe with one exception, with at least as much experience as Ted Cruz. And they're not jumping into the race. And it's because they all signed a letter together saying, yes, we're for Hillary, about 2 years ago, that there was this decision. And I'm really curious about what this race might have looked like if there was that generation of Democrats.
We're going to play Jeopardy here.
Uh-oh.
Nate, you've probably never been asked this question this season at all in particular. Please game a Trump versus Clinton general election.
My instinct, which you shouldn't trust, my instinct is that Trump would motivate the Democratic base like no one else. Therefore, Hillary could run to the center, be the pragmatic, experienced candidate who will have a steady finger on the nuclear button, and therefore gets to have her cake and eat it too, and therefore wins by 8 or 9 points. That's my first instinct.
Does anybody...
However... There's something to the fact, number one, that Trump's broken a lot of rules before, and you should be mindful of that. There's something to the fact, number two, that he will transform and in some ways be the most moderate general election candidate the GOP has nominated in a long time, potentially. And something about the fact that a little bit, like I was saying with Clinton Sanders, where you get two people in a ring and they go round and round and round and round, and there's some element of unpredictability.
What we say in boxing is...
Styles make fights?
That's right.
Styles make fights.
Styles make fights, and just because Frazier can't beat Foreman doesn't mean that Ali beats Frazier.
I would love to see a special sub-survey of predictions about Trump versus Hillary, but where you only ask people who correctly predicted that Trump would win the GOP nomination, if that's what happens. Because, I mean, one of the strangest things about Trump is he's upended so many of the rules that it for me, even when I watch one of these debates, I watch the debate, I think, well, what did I just watch? And then I think, was that good for Trump? Was that bad for Trump? I have absolutely no idea.
Yeah, the one thing I'm sure about a Trump-Hillary race is that it will be so ugly that, you know, that I do not think
it's like
that
a welfare program for journalists.
He's not going to hold back.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. I want to thank Kay, I want to thank Nate and Amy and everybody at Neue Haus, Rhonda Sherman and everybody at The New Yorker. Thank you for inviting us here. Good night.
Amy Davidson and Kella Fasane of The New Yorker with Nate Silver, the founder and editor-in-chief of ESPN's blog 538, recorded just over a week ago at Neue Haus in New York.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.